Hi, I'm Tracy.
And I'm Sharon. And we are Feet of Clay, Confessions of the Cult Sisters. So way back in the 1970s, we became radical Christians in the Jesus movement.
We were promoted to leadership in the crazy cult commune, Last Days Ministries, founded by none other than Christian music megastar Keith Green.
Now we're sharing our decades-long escape from the trauma and abuse of extreme Christianity.
We tell our own stories and also invite guests to talk about fundamentalism, purity culture, arranged marriages, child abuse, misogyny, homophobia, power-hungry patriarchy, and much more.
Much, much more. So join us as we share our journey of healing and humor and how we finally found peace and joy on the other side.
Feet of Clay, Confessions of the Cult Sisters, wherever you get your podcasts.
Episode 111, The Deconversion of Jake. This is Matthew, and in this episode I interview Jake to discuss his deconversion from Christianity. If you have a deconversion story to tell, please get in touch, reasonpress@gmail.com. Please also rate and review Still Unbelievable in your podcasting app. This episode will be published on our YouTube channel. See the links in our show notes. Hello, everybody. This is another episode of Still Unbelievable, going slightly different here. This is just me, your regular co-host, Matthew, and I'm doing a one-on-one interview with Jake. The reason why I'm doing this is a deconstruction interview. Those of you who listen to the Graceful Atheist podcast will already know by now that David is taking a little bit of a break. It's perfectly fine. We all love you, David. We're all going to miss your episodes, but you take the break that you need to take. So what I did was I put a little message up on the Deconstruct Anonymous Facebook group, which is one that's associated with the Graceful Atheist podcast, and said, if there is anybody who fancies doing an interview, I'm very happy to step in and do a couple of interviews. So that's what I'm doing here. So welcome to Still Unbelievable. Jake, how are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
Jake, I'm in the UK, in coastal Somerset in the UK. It's winter here, but it's hovering around about 0 degrees. Tell me where you are.
So I'm down in Georgia, and it's actually surprisingly cold. I deal with a lot of piping in my work, and so this time of year gets very chaotic. The pipes likes to freeze and bust, but yeah, I think it was about 9 degrees this morning, Fahrenheit, so pretty cold.
Right, now this is something that keeps coming up with Andrew and myself. Andrew, my co-host, is in your part of America. He talks in that weird Fahrenheit thing, whereas I'm your standard Celsius person. So we talk numbers which don't mean anything, have very little relevance. So when I say zero, I mean Celsius zero. Yeah. But when you say 9 Fahrenheit, that's a very different temperature, isn't it?
Yeah, I have a lot of friends on Instagram all throughout Europe. And usually I get on my phone and try to Google the conversion chart so I can list both temperatures. So I'm not exactly sure of this morning what 9 Fahrenheit equals to, but it's like negative 10 or somewhere around there.
All right. Let me do a quick test because I've got a smart device here. So let's have a little bit of fun. Alexa, what's 9 degrees Fahrenheit in Celsius? -12.78. Very precise.
Okay. Close.
So yeah, around about -10. Yeah. That's chilly. I don't see temperatures that cold. I saw -8 on my thing, on my thermometer outside in the garden earlier this week. But that's about the coldest it gets in this part of the UK. We're coastal. So we've obviously got a factor there that stabilizes the temperature somewhat. So negative numbers is very rare for me. Anyway, that said, this is middle of January, so this is normal.
Yeah, I'm actually from Seattle, Washington. And I'm used to much colder temperatures, and I did not expect it to get this cold when I moved down to the American South, which is known for being very hot and humid. So I was quite surprised to come down here and find that it does actually get below freezing for a little while, not very long.
Right. Okay. That's where somebody with my level of head hair, cold temperatures really notice.
Yeah.
It's a good job. This is an audio-only podcast. Right. So, Jake, you got in contact with me because of my post over on the Deconversion Anonymous Facebook page about to talk about deconversion. I do recommend that group. That is a very supportive group. I love seeing new people join that group. I love seeing the support that the community gives to each other in that group. If you're struggling with deconversion, deconstruction, and you want a supportive community to answer any of the questions, I do recommend that Facebook group. So thank you for getting in touch with me, Jake. So let's start at the beginning.
Sure.
Tell me about your upbringing, your early introductions to Christianity, if there were any, and how you ended up on the Christian train.
So I was not raised in any kind of religious home. I do believe my brother and I were both like baptized at the local Episcopal church, you know, when we were like 3 months old. But beyond that, we didn't go to church regularly. It wasn't something that we did. And then my parents split when I was like 4 or 5. And I just don't recall my parents either saying anything, whether positive or negative, regarding religion or church. It was just a non-issue growing up. So growing up with my divorced parents, I lived with my dad and saw my mom every other weekend. But my dad was, he was an alcoholic. He had his own issues. So his kind was just go to work, come home, drink, pass out in his room. He was not like abusive in any way. So what that meant was that like my brother and I had this open childhood because we had no structure. So I make the joke sometimes that if I had been raised by wolves, it would have been an improvement. And just because we didn't have to sneak out of the house, we just left whenever we felt like it. There was no structure, no discipline, no rewards or consequences. So we just did what we felt like it. And as kids, that was pretty cool. As I got older, I realized I missed a lot of discipline and structure and, you know, relationship bonding. But my curious nature into the world just led me down all these many different paths because I was pretty open and willing to do just about anything. And eventually that led to alcohol at a pretty early age, you know, in middle school. Like I was 14, or I guess that'd be the beginning of high school, around 14. Started drinking and followed in my dad's footsteps to where I was drinking every single day of my senior year of high school. Like I carried the little miniature bottles of liquor with me to school and I would step out of the class, go to the restroom and drink that. And during my lunches, my friend and I would leave, go get some like fast food or something. I'd run by my house and I'd pour probably like 6 shots of vodka back into whatever drink that I was having. Because our fourth period class right after lunch was an art class. And the teacher allowed the seniors to bring in food and drink from lunch. So I would literally be sitting in my art class and I'd be drinking vodka and Coke or vodka and orange juice or something. And that was just steadily getting out of hand, you could say.
Yeah.
To where even as a junior, senior year in high school, I was at home even just drinking by myself, you know, and I was going downhill in a real hurry. So what this led up to was my graduation night. And again, I don't need to get into all the details except that I fully blacked out. So the only thing I know is what my friends told me afterwards. And apparently I drank an enormous amount of alcohol. You know, I had old wine that my dad made in college, vodka, malt liquor, I mean, all of it. And I fully blacked out and was laying in the ditches when we went out driving around. And anyway, the amount that I had should have killed me through alcohol poisoning. And then the situation of getting back into my house, my friends brought me back to the house and told me to go climb into my window because I had a window that opened up and my bed was underneath it. But apparently I broke into a different window, fell into the bathtub, and it landed on my head and neck. So I looked at that night and thought, I have no idea why I'm still alive, you know, and I'm only 18 years old. So that woke me up to where I realize I have to make a change or I'm literally going to be dead. So one of my closest friends grew up in the church, and he was the kind who was always inviting us over, you know, inviting us over for Wednesday, and then we'd stay for Bible study, or invite us to stay the night on Saturday, and then we'll go to church on Sunday, you know, and we put up with it for a while. And finally, I thought, I guess I should start going to church with him, you know. His family was one of these, I don't know, kind of leave it to Beaver families, you know, and it seemed fake to me because my family was so broken and dysfunctional. So when I saw his family where they all sat around the table for dinner and talked and about their day, it just seemed like there's something wrong with this. You know, that's not how families are. I started hanging out with them and realized, no, they're genuine in this, you know, and it's not that they're perfect, but they're trying to act like a family, you know. So I just started spending time with them, going to church, and around 19 years, I was baptized. And I come from the Church of Christ tradition, which is a very conservative, borderline legalistic church, but they do believe in full immersion in water for baptism. That's where you receive the Holy Spirit. So I was baptized at 19 and just started learning. I guess I was excited. Was excited to get away from the drunkenness that I had been in and start learning. And learning what I was being told was the secrets to the universe, you know. So it was new. It was structure. It was a good structure of people around, too.
Okay, so the obvious question then to ask there is that structure that you saw there, did you find that attractive? Was that something you thought that you needed to gravitate towards?
Yeah, because at that time, I believe that left to my own devices, I was heading straight towards an early death.
Right. So that experience you had on your graduation night, that had some kind of dramatic personal, don't know what word, awakening or realization in you, and that was a key moment to you, and that was the reference point from which you started looking for change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so if that hadn't have happened, you might have had a different priority when you were 19?
I would say, yeah, it's highly possible. Okay. I mean, my uncle was in the military, and he had told me that I think he saw that I was aimless and directionless. Yeah. And he went out, was like, in my senior year of high school, he told me that I really needed to consider joining the Army.
Right.
And I think he was smart in realizing this kid needs some sort of discipline and structure. And But at that time, the Army was the exact opposite of anything I wanted to do. You know, I just wanted to party and drink.
Yeah.
So the church stepped in at the right time because it provided a sense of structure and family. And I go to church every Sunday. I see the same people. I'm going to start learning from these wise elder men, you know, and yeah. it was good. And I guess you could even say it served its purpose at that time. You know, it probably did save my life in a way.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be said for some kind of social rigidity in terms of behavior for stopping people from wasting their life, to, if you'll let me use that phrase. I've seen it in people that I know as well. I'm thinking of a particular individual I know from school who was a bit like that. And he ended up joining the Army. And you look at him now and he's a completely different individual, and he's very supportive, and he credits that rigidity of the Army structure to helping him turn his life around.
Yeah, I sometimes think maybe that's what I should have done, but it didn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter now. Either way, I needed something in my life to kind of get me on track.
Going back a little bit earlier then, forgive me if this is personal and you don't have to answer, your dad's drinking, was that related to the divorce or was that already part of his character?
And I don't mind talking about my dad. He passed on in 2004. We have been able to completely rebuild our relationship.
Right.
So I love my dad's, and that's embracing the darkness that he went through personally. And so what I learned from him, he was aimless like me. And he came from a family that was very formal. Like everybody else in his family is very formal, and he was aimless. So he chose a career, which was law, simply because it meant more school and he didn't know what he wanted to do.
Right.
When he graduated, he started a small little law firm in just a small town south of Seattle, nothing big and fancy. And he met someone and got married, you know, and started having kids. But I think he was struggling with his own demons of, you know, demons, I guess you call it, but of not knowing what it was that he actually wanted to do.
Okay.
He just following a career path because it meant something to do. And it meant something with his very formal parents and brothers and sisters. And so I think his drinking just became his own escape from life, you know. And then they did get divorced early. And so that led to, I think, to a depression because, I mean, and I'm assuming a lot of this, but I think it just led to him being disillusioned with his own life. And so he used alcohol as a means of escape. And I just saw that then as because I guess maybe because he wasn't abusive, either verbally or physically. I didn't fully see it at the time as a bad thing. It's just what he did. So for me, it was like, I want to experiment with this too.
Right.
You know, and until it began to get me to where I'm drinking, getting drunk by myself at home, you know, at 17. And I was like, okay, you know, it's going, it hadn't reached the point of being too bad yet, but it was definitely headed that direction quick.
Yeah, and that transition from preteen into adulthood, and you start to get access to mobility and alcohol and drugs, even to some people, and starting to realize that there are things that are within your grasp, which at one point in your life never were. It's an exciting time doing other things, exploring the limits of what you are and are not able to do. And that is what we are like as curious individuals. We push those boundaries and we try to achieve what we can do. You know, when I think of some of the things that I got up to at that point in stage, living in Zambia with a friend who drove a number of times, we went out, got drunk, transported ourselves home, all of us drunk. You know, and I think through those kind of things, I think the number of opportunities for something disastrous happening were quite high.
Yeah.
And as a parent myself, it shudders that my own offspring might do something that I did, which is quite a strange place to be.
Yeah. It's scary. It definitely is. I have a 17-year-old son, and I think it's not long before he's, you know, potentially moving out, and whatever it is that he chooses to do, there's going to be that time where he's going to experiment with life and do things. And you just hope that, that it goes well, that he survives. I had friends in school that did pass away, you know, whether from drugs or alcohol or different things. And all the times that we would sneak liquor bottles into heavy metal concerts and then drink, and my friends would smoke weed, and then we drive home and you think, how in the world did we actually escape and get through all of it?
So, yes. During all this time, how was the relationship with your mother?
It was scattered because she was kind of unstable in a way. Like, she didn't have a great paying job, which is why we lived with my dad, which is probably not normal, but he was a lawyer and he made, you know, like I said, we weren't wealthy, but he did just fine. And my mom didn't have stable jobs. She was flaky, I guess you could say, but a sweetheart, you know, a nice person. But we only saw her every other weekend. And so it wasn't so much about being mother and son as opposed to we're just going to try to have fun for the weekend.
Yeah.
So we had a good relationship, but as far as like a mother son, same with my, you know, or a father son, I just didn't have those relationships with either of my parents.
Right. Okay. So let's get back to where you were in your story then. So you're 19, you've found friendship and some stability and some structure in a church family and in church environment. And very quickly, committed to the point where you decided to get baptized.
Yep.
How did that change the relationship between you and your immediate family?
I don't know that it changed a whole lot right then and there. Because, like I said, I grew up so independent of them in the first place. I just did my own thing always. So my relationship with them didn't change a whole lot. When I was, although interestingly, around that time, maybe I was 17, now that I go back, was actually around the time my dad got sober.
Right.
He went to a care unit for a couple of weeks and got into rehab and met who became his third wife.
Okay.
So actually, after I became a Christian at 19, it was around in my early 20s that my dad and I actually started building a relationship. And he was doing that with me and my brother. And he would take my brother to like baseball games, see the Seattle Mariners or the Seahawks. And then he would take me golfing, you know, or he'd take the both of us out for steaks, you know. So actually, in a way, my relationship with my dad got much better. And that was great. And then my relationship with mom was about the same. It just always kind of scattered, you know.
Okay. So again, just for my English and non-American listeners, the Seahawks and the Mariners, is that baseball and American football?
Yeah, the Seattle Mariners are the Major League Baseball and the Seahawks right. are football, yeah.
Right. Okay. Good. To the English ears, football is a very different sport.
Yes,
so, it is. So those are two games that we don't see very often here in the UK. So just trying to to get clarity on that. It's soccer and tennis tends to be the big sports here in the UK. Oh, and cricket as well.
Yeah, and our football actually has more to do with your hands than it does with the feet. You know?
I know.
Yeah, it's kind of silly.
yes. But you are the land that drive on a parkway and park on a driveway. So, you know.
There's a lot of things here that don't make any sense.
Right. That, ladies and gentlemen, was our comic interlude. You can catch us every Thursday night at somewhere. So moving on then. So you have established that you are your own man at this point in life. Yeah, you've realized that you are capable of making your own adult decisions, and there aren't many people who will question those. So how did that then change as you progressed into Christianity? What did your Christian journey become after you'd made this commitment?
I guess hindsight is kind of funny because I look back and I can see how I went through different phases. The initial phase was, I guess it was at first just excitement for learning something and feeling like you're learning the answers to all of life and existence. Yeah. Like this makes sense. You know, everything before this point was leading me to an early death. It was chaotic. And now I've got something that's like, no, here's the answer for everything. So I just absolutely dove in. I dove right into the Bible. And the churches of Christ that I've always been a part of were very conservative, but very focused on just what the Bible says. There wasn't a lot of, like, we call it a cult of personality, you know, with specific preachers.
Yeah.
In fact, the church that I was in didn't have a preacher. There was three elders, you know, and a couple of deacons and an evangelist, and they all rotated Sunday morning sermons. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I appreciated that because it wasn't about following this one person's teachings. It was about, no, everything's just about the Bible. So I started taking classes with one of the elders and a friend, just simply learning the books of the Bible and going through and understanding who wrote them and what they're about and what they mean and how it applies. And that was just exciting for me. It's like I was learning. My curious brain was gathering information and knowledge and feeling like I'm understanding the world. And that was exciting. It was all about scripture and learning, but that led to legalism, to where I wanted to do everything I possibly could to be right in every tiny little detail. And I took a road trip twice, actually. I took a big road trip with a friend of mine. And we were convincing ourselves that we were going to go to hell if we were jaywalking, because, wow, you know, the Bible talks about obeying civil law. So if we break the civil law, then we're sinning, you know, and it was just getting crazy, because you start analyzing life on that level and there's just no way you can live. There's no way you can be, you know, and thankfully that didn't last very long, but it was a genuine pursuit to think, I need to be right. I need to be righteous before God. And every action, you know, plays into that.
Do you think there might have been an element of your thinking then, or the group thinking, that if you let the slightest, if you slip on the slightest little thing and you allow it and you don't feel guilty about it, then that opens the door to letting other bigger, more important things also slide?
Yeah, I think so. It was that level of micromanaging, yeah, everything you said or did, because you didn't want to give the devil a foothold.
Mm.
And I'm not saying that the church, the church itself was teaching that from the pulpit. It was just my learning. And then I had several other friends and we all kind of joined the church at the same time. And we were feeding off of each other's energy of wanting to micromanage and make sure we were righteous. And again, not to give the devil a foothold. So it just kind of drove ourselves insane. It couldn't last long.
No, that sounds like it's the potential for an environment that creates an awful lot of psychological pressure in terms, yeah, of behavior and coherence.
Yeah,
and it must be quite emotionally draining as well.
It was exhausting. And one of the things they did on Sunday nights was they would try to get some of the younger men to practice their preaching. So they might, like, we had Sunday night church service and they'd bring in two or three younger guys and do shorter sermons. So there's a little bit of wanting to keep up with everybody else, you know, yeah, like other guys are doing sermons, therefore I want to start preaching too. And so we were looking at each other and just feeding off each other to be righteous and do everything right and make sure you're preaching and doing all these things like a little checklist. And yeah, it's extremely exhausting to not even allow yourself just to live, because you're trying to achieve all of these certain little things.
Yeah. And presumably then you spend lots of time double guessing yourself on every little decision that you make.
Yeah.
I remember a similar stage in my own life, early 20s, with a friend of mine, and he had a fairly good job at a bank. So he was the first of us to buy his own apartment. And I remember him getting really excited about this apartment that he was going to buy. And he said to me quietly one day, he says, am I allowed to pray to God that I get this apartment? Would it be a sin if I made this prayer? And yeah, you know, I said, no, I don't think it would be. But when I think that back now, he'd clearly spent some period of time stressing and worrying over whether he was even allowed to pray that he would be able to afford or be able to get this apartment, you know, whether it was breaching some kind of prayer code. And when I look back at it now, I think the strain and stress that we were putting on ourselves at that time on life to certain types of perfect behavior. And it's only when we take a step back from the outside and look at it, and we go, golly, the amount of damage that we do to ourselves with that kind of micromanaging.
Yeah, absolutely. One of our friends was this guy who was very focused and determined, and he was going to buy a townhome at a pretty young age. Like, it was kind of amazing to us that he was going to be buying a house, you know. But he was stressing about it so much, even to the point where he was trying to debate whether or not he should get a VCR, you know, to watch VHS videotapes, because he thought it might be vanity.
Right. Yeah.
And we were having this long discussion in the car, me and him and a couple of the friends, as to whether or not you should pray to God for a VCR. Like, does God care? And if he does care, does he care how much money you spend on it and these this and things? And I thought, I mean, look, at the time, it just seemed so important. Like, we really need to figure this one out. You know, now I look back and think, well, how stupid and silly and stressful.
Yeah.
Over buying a stupid little VCR. But we're stressed whether or not we're going to make the right decision before God. So it's, yeah, you drive yourself insane with that.
Yeah, and I think this is the exuberance of youth. And I think this is the danger of this kind of legalistic structure, is the exuberance of youth can tap into that in a very unhealthy way. I've experienced it myself. I've seen others experience it. And you're clearly talking about similar experiences. And I look back and I think, couldn't we have just had more fun? Yeah. You can have fun safely without it being sinful, and you end up with a better quality of life if you don't put all of this unnecessary strain on yourselves.
Yeah, I realized the dichotomy of the life that I lived beforehand was absolutely nothing but chasing fun. It was drinking all the time, going to concerts, chasing women with my friends, you know, and then suddenly switching gears to this completely legalistic thing where I'm going to go to hell if I'm jaywalking. And that kind of flip, I don't know, it's not good. You know, you're still at the time 18, 19 years old. I mean,
yeah.
And you're stressing your life out that much.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah, I think there's a good lesson here on human psyche, and I think we see it in a lot of things, is, you know, life can be like a pendulum. And you know, if you start really far up on one side, when the pendulum swings, there's a very real danger that you'll swoop past the sensible middle ground and end up at the equivalent opposite position. And it sounds like you kind of did something like that.
Yeah, and it plays into the idea of being taught that we are sinners.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we need saving. So when the Bible says, you know, there's no one good and no one seeks good, you know, and so I look at that and I go, well, yeah, here I was killing myself with alcohol. And now I'm being told that no one's good. No one can achieve salvation on their own. They need God's help. So it plays into thinking I'm a bad person on my own. You know, I'm just a sinner deserving of damnation on my own. So I have to now get this right and be right before God so that I don't end up in hell. And yeah, that's just a horrible way to live, really.
Yeah. So did this help you get the alcohol consumption under control? Were you now in an acceptable level of alcohol consumption now at this point?
For a short period of time. Ultimately, I don't think it was Christianity that solved that problem.
Right.
I ended up solving that problem later on in life on my own, really. I think to get deeper into, you know, the ideas of our shadow selves and, you know, we're getting metaphysical and stuff. But when you start repressing certain things and telling yourself that these attitudes and these desires and stuff are bad and evil and sinful, so you shove it down.
Yeah.
That does not solve anything.
No.
So it ends up showing up. So what I ended up doing was I would be good with alcohol for a long time. And then at some point I would go to a friend's house and then completely lose control and get wild and drunk, you know? And it's like, well, this really isn't solving the problem.
No.
I just had to mature, and I can have bottles of whiskey up on my shelf right now and I may not even touch it for a month. It's just it doesn't have a hold on me anymore. But it wasn't the church that did that, you know. That was just telling myself you're sinful and bad, and that's not a good strategy for long-term health.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point to nail to the board, if you'll forgive me the analogy there, because repressing something doesn't actually address any of the issues.
No, not at all. It just, you can push it down for so long, but it's going to come back.
Leaving that aside, because it sounds like we're going to return to that subject then at some point, but going back to your Christian journey then, so you're in this community, you're growing as an adult, you are spending time studying the Bible. What happened next? What happened when you hit your 20s and you got into your 20s?
I started getting more involved with the youth groups and youth camps, and I moved to Spokane, Washington, which is on the eastern border of Washington State with Idaho. And I moved out there to kind of be a secondhand man to the youth leader at a church there. And this was like my first time moving away from home, you know, being around new people. But It was a good experience because my ego got the best of me over there. When I started preaching and teaching, I was obsessing over the content in the sermon. Like, I might spend a month on a 15-minute sermon just because I was obsessing over it.
Right.
But I started getting praise right away from people saying, wow, you're a natural at this, you know? And so I kind of gave myself a big head. I started thinking, man, I'm really good at this, you know? And the counter of my obsession when I started thinking that I was really good was that I stopped obsessing over everything. I thought, I'm really good. I can do this. I can throw something together the night before.
Yeah.
And that got the best of me because I started falling apart again. You know, I started being undisciplined, and that just, it just showed up in the quality of what I was doing. It just showed that I didn't have a handle on myself like I thought I did. And so it was time to go back to learning. It's time to realize you are, I guess, reinforcing the idea that left to myself, I am a bad person. That was just kind of what the message I was giving myself was, if I don't keep up this standard of Christianity and I'm left to myself, I will ruin everything, you know? And it didn't matter if it was alcohol. It didn't matter if it was in the church. Just, I was inherently a bad person. So I had to maintain a standard set by others because I couldn't go by my own standard, you know? And so the time in Spokane was a good learning experience. You know, I walked away thinking that was God who was stretching my boundaries and showing me who I really was. So I was still filled with this idea of God being active in my life, and he's teaching me, and I'm growing and I'm learning. And I think the truth was, looking back, I wasn't growing and learning for myself. I was growing and thinking, I really am a bad person. Therefore, I have to maintain this Christian standard if I have going to have any hope.
It's funny because what I've just heard you say is you had the ability to put hours and hours of effort into a presentation. Mm-hmm. And the result of those hours and hours of effort was something that people really appreciated. That sounds like that's you doing that.
Yeah, I think that was more me than anything else, you know. It's like when and to kind of go on a slightly side jog, what I learned from myself and when I went to see a therapist last year was that I have OCD, and it's not
right.
The physical compulsion thing. It's a more of a mental living in your head obsession. And that's what I have. I obsess over things in my head. I have to think about it. I have to turn it over. I have to solve the problem. And that part of it, I truly enjoyed when I was putting together a sermon or a lesson, because I could spend hours obsessing over details and information and organizing my outline to get it all right. And when I put in that effort, it came up with something pretty good.
Yeah.
And then when I got an ego, because I thought God had not anointed me, but I thought God had led me here to be a preacher and a teacher, and I'm doing a special job, that's when I lost control. In both scenarios, it's all on me.
Yeah.
Either I was putting in the time and the effort and producing results, or I quit putting in the time and effort and it falls apart.
I think there's a warning we should take from what you've just said, that if we're too prepared to acknowledge God for the things that we have done, then there is a risk that we become lazy because it's not us. So what's the point of me doing the effort? Because it's not me that's producing this quality. It's God working through me. So I may as well just let it flow. Why do I need to put in the effort when it's God, not me? And I think there's a very real lesson that we should learn there.
I completely agree, you know, and we just attribute all of these things in life to some divine source. And it takes the responsibility off of ourselves. Mm. If we think that God is the one who's anointing us and who's guiding us, and we say he's in control of everything, and you know, we're told to just give it all to God and give it over to him and trust in him. But what you actually see is your results in life depend on the effort you put into it.
Yeah.
And if you quit putting effort into something, it's going to fall apart. And if you put the time and effort, it'll work. But it's better to own it for yourself instead of just say that it's all due to some other entity.
Mm.
You know, I really, really oppose that idea of putting responsibility onto something else. It's on you, which is very empowering too, because it tells you when you put your mind to something, you can achieve.
Yes. You know,
what are you passionate about? Well, go seek after it. Don't put it in the hands of some creator. Put it in your own hands and go do it.
Yeah, engage your passions. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. And on the flip side, if someone's trying to tell you that you're anointed for something, but you don't feel passionate about it, look in other places. You know, be brave enough to question whether, if it's not your passion, it's really right for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be brave.
Agree.
Yeah. Ask yourself what excites you.
Yeah, you're going to waste time. You're going to cause yourself stress. You're going to be unhappy pursuing things that are not you.
Yeah.
And even if other people are telling you this is what you should be doing, if you shouldn't be doing it, then it's just not going to work out well for you.
Yeah. So with all of this and these successes from this hard work, did you consider any form of Christian ministry?
I did. For a while, I thought, well, this is my direction then, you know, so I'll just keep working. I'll keep working with youth groups. I was never a paid minister, but I'll keep working with the youth groups and I'll keep preaching and I'll keep teaching adult Sunday classes. And eventually it'll work out. You know, I'll be able to have my own ministry. Maybe I'll become a youth minister at some point. And that was definitely the path. Even though I'm a pretty extreme introvert and a bit antisocial, so I don't know that ministry would have actually been the right path. To where your whole job deals with dealing with people and their problems all day, that would have been very tough for me. But the preaching and the teaching part were good. It's like stepping up on stage to preach. You feel disconnected from the crowd and you step into a different zone. And I could almost be a different version of myself. So that part was good, but maybe the constant daily dealing with people would actually not have been very good.
Yes. Yeah, it must be challenging somebody who's, because not everybody's an extrovert. Now, I'm a bit of an extrovert. I enjoy dialogue with people. It stimulates me. It excites me. But not everybody feels that way. For some people, it's genuinely a tiring and draining experience.
I thoroughly enjoy it. I just need the counterbalance of being alone for a while after, you know, to recharge. I can have like hours long discussions with friends and then I won't have to see them for a month or two, you know.
Yeah, I understand. So you explored a little bit that idea. At what point did you realize or decide that this really wasn't for you? And what direction did you go then?
So I can credit an atheist friend of mine that I worked with asking some very direct pointed questions that stuck with me for years. We would have these long talks and we'd stay up till 3 a.m. sometimes and just discussing these things. And there were a lot of times where I could answer questions for him that he had about Christianity, but he asked one question or said one comment about the idea of hell. And he said that what kind of God needs to use the fear of hell to keep people in line? And that's one that I just had an extremely difficult time ever coming up with a rational answer for, you know, I mean. I know we rationalize it in the church. We, you know, many people say, well, that's people's free will choice, and that's why they go to hell, and we're sinful, and all these things. But you just go back to what kind of God would that have to be to create a system where if someone just doesn't believe it, that they're going to suffer in hell for eternity. And I just, that stuck with me for years. Even though I stayed in the church for a long time, that stuck with me. I just could never really get my mind around that one. Mm-hmm. And that, so that's why I say my deconstruction probably started 15 years ago, and I didn't even know it. But yeah. Little questions kept coming up that I just could not get past those questions, and eventually leading to, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, where I could no longer avoid those questions. And so him asking me about hell, and then my curious nature, I started looking into Einstein and relativity, and I was curious about science and looked into the string theory just because I needed information. You know, it's like we talk about the OCD, and my brain needs something that I can obsess over. So if I reach to a point of a topic where I feel like I've got a decent handle on it, I've got to replace it with something else. So it moved on to sciences. And once it moved on to sciences, you start realizing how science works within the church and within the secular world. And the basic idea that science is built on thousands of years and millions of scientists around the world building upon each other. And as hypotheses and theories and tests and experiments continue to prove themselves true, then they keep using those as building blocks and moving forward. And when things don't prove themselves true, then they discard it. You know, anytime a scientist comes up with a theory or an idea, there's a thousand other scientists who are going to want to prove them wrong. So all of these ideas that prove themselves true repeatedly, they just continue to build generation after generation. Mm-hmm. And that's just looking at the world as it is, versus the Christian science is taking a book written thousands of years ago by, you know, dubious nature and dubious authors, and giving you a basic outline. And now every bit of your science and data, you have to force it to fit that book. And I thought, that's not science. That can't be true. Like, how could that possibly answer the world if you're just given this book and say everything you find must fit this book? So a scientist has to discard any data that goes against the Bible. Mm-hmm. So when you come to like the ages of the universe and the ages of the earth, and you know, every scientific secular science test can prove the dating methods to, you know, thinking the earth is over 4 billion years old.
Yeah.
Then you want to count the Bible and say, well, no, if you count Bible genealogy, it's no more than 10,000 years.
Yeah.
So guys like Ken Ham, who is, I don't know if you know who that is,
American. Yeah.
So he any data that he would have about the age of Earth, he has to force that data to fit the biblical narrative.
Yes.
Versus it just being what it is.
So from this Christian tradition then that you've gone into, was that a young earth creationist tradition?
Yeah, absolutely.
It was, right. Yeah. So when you were exploring these scientific avenues, did that create some cognitive dissonance in you when you were trying to work things out?
Yeah, I'd say 100%. We were given books that were based on Christian science. So these were supposedly scientists who believed in a young earth creation. And so those were the books that we were given to read. And if you filter your education through one direction, it's easy to believe those things because they have scientific evidence and proof for why they believe the earth is no more than 10,000 years old.
Yeah.
So if you stay in that avenue, that's what you're going to think and believe. It seems reasonable, you know. So that's one of the reasons why I think it's so, so important to look for information outside of your normal sphere of knowledge, you know. Seek counterpoints, look at different points of view and be able to compare the two, and things start becoming a bit more clear.
Yes, it helps you to analyze and critically question the bubble that you're in to be able to identify, are there things in my bubble that are right? And more importantly, are there things in my bubble that are wrong? And you don't get to be able to quantify that if you're not exploring other areas. Even if some of those areas you explore turn out to be wrong, if you haven't explored it, you haven't been able to critically analyze what you already hold.
Right. You're essentially being told what to believe versus learning for yourself what is true.
Yes. So at this point then, had you met your future wife? Were you married, or did that come along later?
Let's see. I met her about a year or two after I was baptized. You know, so I was around 20 or something, and I met her at one of the youth camps. Mm-hmm. We did not start dating at all right away. We had just been friends for probably a good 10 years because I lived in Seattle. She was in Spokane. Then her family moved to Florida for a while. We were just friends for probably a good decade before anything ever happened as far as that goes.
So you'd already had this interaction with this atheist friend of yours by the time you did actually start dating and get married?
Yeah, it was around the same time.
Okay.
I met my atheist friend at work, and then I got married maybe a couple of years, 2 or 3 years after that.
Right.
So.
Okay, so you were unknowingly being poked and prodded around about that time. So even whether you knew it or not, the early seeds of deconstruction were there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And does your wife come from that same fundamentalist Christian tradition?
Yeah. And her family's all in. Her grandpa, a preacher. Her dad wasn't a preacher, but he was very, and still is, very intimately involved with the churches and Christian counseling. And and not to say this disparagingly, but they're kind of the quintessential, you know, generational Christian family.
Right.
And it is their life. It's who they are, you know.
Yes, I think that's one point to just pause and clear. I'm pretty sure that most of the audience already appreciate this, but just to say it anyway, for a great many of Christians, probably everyone who takes their Christianity seriously, Christianity is an intrinsic part of their identity. They see it as part of who they are. It's not just an opinion they hold. It is an essential core of what makes them them. It's an essential element of their personality, of their self-identity. And it's important that we acknowledge that.
Yeah. And it's the center core of which you make all the decisions in your life.
Yes.
Everything you do, you know, if you want to change jobs, if you want to move, you know, whether you're going to get married or go to school or all these different things come down to, well, you need to pray about it because you need God to guide you into whatever you're doing. So you end up building absolutely everything in your life off of this central faith. Yeah. So it's not just that here I am doing what I'm doing and I've happened to believe this. No, it's it's the very foundation that you build everything in your life off of.
Yeah. So you'd entered married life. Would you say you were still had creationist leanings at this point, or were you shaking those off already?
No, I was deep in the rationalization. You know, even though my friend was asking me questions, I was still filled with the idea that God was leading my life, and it just meant maybe I didn't understand everything yet. So
yeah.
Every time he'd ask me questions, I would rationalize it, you know, I could go to one of the elders in the church and ask them, and they would give me the answer for it. And I'd think, okay, well, that apparently explains it.
Yeah. You know, and you said earlier that you had an inquisitive mind and you loved absorbing things scientific, which is very similar to my own story. And because I came from a creationist background, and I always say that it was science that rescued me from that. So is that also true for you? And could you paint me a bit of a picture of what it was scientifically that started to put those cracks into creationism?
It was my love of astrophysics.
Yeah.
And the cosmos. So even when I was like 15, I remember the house that I grew up on had a relatively flat roof. Mm. And so on, if there was a clear night and a full moon, I would climb up on my roof with a foam camping pad and I would lay down in a sleeping bag and just lay on the roof, you know, staring at the moon. I was just absolutely fascinated with it. And over the years, I would sometimes just find myself on the back deck. I didn't have any great big telescopes or anything, but I would just stare at the stars and I'd see that some would change colors and I'd try to draw pictures of it. Mm. So then, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, somewhere around there, I just really started diving in because I wanted to learn and understand and I wanted to go to space, you know?
Yeah. And
so I started watching space movies and just getting into it. And I think getting onto like YouTube a decade ago or whenever it was, and suddenly finding videos and making learning easier, you know, accessing information was a lot easier. And, you know, you could go to the bookstore and get a huge book on astrophysics and just be so overwhelmed. There's no way you're going to read that book.
Yeah.
You don't understand the equations. You can't. But you can watch a 10-minute video, you know, with animation about the scale of the universe and be like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And so that's what I started doing and started trying to understand the scale of the universe, which is unfathomable. Mm-hmm. But trying to understand it, trying to grasp it and going over the size of the Milky Way, you know, and so you do simple things like, the Milky Way is approximately 100,000 light years across. And so you think, okay, well, how fast is the speed of light? Yeah. And then you learn how fast it is. And then you learn that it would take 100,000 years to get across this one galaxy. So you kind of understand the enormity of just the Milky Way.
Yes.
And then you can expand that out and think, that's just one galaxy.
Yep.
And the nearest galaxy, and I'm going to mess up this number. I forget how many billions of light years, or I forget how far away the Andromeda galaxy is, but it's the closest galaxy to us.
4 million light years or something like that.
I think the number 4 is what was sticking in my head, but I couldn't remember exact.
Shall we run another test? Shall we? Alexa, yeah. How far away is the Andromeda galaxy? 28.4 million trillion kilometers. There we go. Convert that to light years if you dare.
Yeah.
I think I heard a statistic this week which puts into context what you've just said, and I'm going to try and remember it correctly, but I think what it said was if I can't remember whether it was our sun or our solar system was the size of a blood cell, then our galaxy would be the size of continental United States.
Yeah.
These are comparisons and sizes which just boggle the mind.
And I absolutely love those because you're trying to put into scale something that you essentially can't understand. So the Andromeda galaxy being however many kilometers Alexa just said, and then you think, but that again is just two galaxies out of billions of galaxies. So
yeah,
you expand that out and then you think, okay, well, how big must God be? If God is the creator of this, and if he is outside of time and space, and this is how huge the universe is, so how big and great and vast is God? And then you think, that makes him really, really small and petty to be doing what he's doing with religion on Earth.
Yeah.
Like if he's this deity who can tell you exactly what's going on inside of a black hole, is he really all that concerned if a woman is kissing a woman here on Earth that he would threaten them with eternal hell?
Yeah.
It's like, how can you make a God that big and then make him that small and petty? And then you think, oh, that's what man does.
Yeah.
That's a man-made God.
There's an interesting flip in perspective that you've done there. And I think it goes to show the arrogance that Christianity or certain brands of Christianity put on the human. And that is, you've said that when you look at the universe as a whole, all of that majesty, all of that enormity in size, and all the things that are going on a chemical level as well as a planetary level in terms of orbital mechanics, etc., in all those places so far away that we'll never even visually see them from this planet, and yet God should be interested in a tiny speck of human being. It's an interesting way that you phrase that. Yet the Christian would say all of that majesty there is created for the pleasure of the human being here, because the human being is that important.
Yeah, that was one of the turning points for me. Once I started realizing that if God was that big, why is he so concerned about us?
Yeah.
And why is he so concerned if we believe the right thing?
Yeah.
To then make an eternal hell that 100,000 billion trillion years would only be the beginning of. And you're like, and so I'm trying not to be crude. In my personal life, I tend to cuss like a sailor, but if you'd allow, one thing I would say to Christians is, if you're going to talk about
we're a cussing free podcast here. We don't have any such limitations. So go ahead.
If you as a Christian believe in hell being literally eternal conscious torment, and the Bible says a lake of fire, so I picture a pit of lava.
Yeah.
You know, and you can picture Gollum in the movie when he falls into the lava inside Mount Doom, except freeze him at the point where he's just in maximum pain.
Yeah.
And say, that's where you're going to stay. Yeah. Then I would say to Christians, please do me the honor. Give me the respect of calling it what it is and call it fucking hell.
Yeah.
Because you're telling people that if they don't believe rightly, if you're going to deny the thousands of years of science built off generations of provable, testable theories and ideas, and if someone believes that they're going to go to fucking hell for eternity, I really want you to think about that, you know, because you're saying that this God who's so far beyond our scale of understanding,
yeah,
but then so small and petty about what we're doing on Earth, that you're going to get tortured for the whole of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
Like that can't be right. I can't possibly get on board with that.
No, and I agree. Gonna have a quick advert break here. If you're a new listener to Still Unbelievable and you're joining just for the pleasure of this conversation with Jake, firstly, welcome and thank you. I'm sure Jake will thank you as well. Go back a couple of episodes to episode 108, where Andrew and I have a fabulous conversation with Derek Kublis, who has written the book Holy Hell, A Case Against Eternal Damnation. And this addresses the very point that Jake's just brought up here. A hell of torment and torture is a hell that increasingly Christians are saying, hang on a minute, I didn't sign up for this. This doesn't sound loving. How can we make the concept of God more loving? And the conclusion that people are rapidly coming to is, hell is not what the evangelicals typically say it is. And this is a very convincing book and a very, very beautiful conversation that Andrew and I have with Derek Kublis about hell and hell not being eternal torment. And everybody, well, go and listen to the episode. You'll get no spoilers here. So the concept of hell, Jake, at some point became a bit of a turnoff for you. That thought, that problem, that question just wouldn't go away. What happened next?
It was very around the same time that I decided to watch, and I'm sure many people have watched this too, the debate between Bill Nye and Ken Ham.
Yeah.
And I don't usually watch debates feeling like they're there to convert someone from one side to the other side.
No.
I just wanted to hear both perspectives and see what they had to say. And what I came away from was, again, if you're biased towards the young earth creation, you're going to walk away from that debate believing Ken Ham won the debate. You know, and if you're pro-evolution, you'll be rooting for Bill Nye, and you'll walk away thinking Bill Nye did a great job. What I thought was, Bill Nye presented reasonable evidence for everything he said.
Yeah.
So if you simply chose based on reasonable evidence, and you chose to follow the ideas of evolution and secular science, like, that's at least a reasonable decision. But that's going to cost you eternity in hell. So now I'm combining the two, the science and the physics, mm-hmm. with the idea of hell. So someone could choose to follow secular science because it's a reasonable choice, and they're going to suffer eternity in hell. And I thought, how in the world could God do that to someone for making a reasonable decision? And so combining those ideas, I was like, no, there's something wrong here. This doesn't make any sense at all. And that really kickstarted the more direct deconstruction.
Yeah.
I really started looking at Christianity going, this part can't be right. So if this is wrong, what else could be wrong? And I looked into the idea of annihilation. I know, I believe there's some Christian groups that teach that you're just annihilated when you're done. But then I thought, well, who cares then? Like, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
If I can just live my life on my terms, and when I'm done, I'm done. Well, then you guys just need to, you know, chill out a little bit. It's not that big a deal.
Right.
And so they actually need the idea of eternal punishment.
They need something to rescue you from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They need that. They need that as leverage.
Yeah.
And so hell or annihilation didn't work. I couldn't see that working either way. Science, Christian science versus secular science. No, you guys aren't making any sense. You're forcing the data to fit a preconceived idea instead of just letting it be what it is. Then we had issues with finding a church here in Georgia. We were having troubles with the culture here is very different than it was in Washington State. You know, they call this the Bible Belt down here. And families go to churches for generations and generations. And you go to a church and you see families who have been in that church for generations and generations. And there's a lot of cliques. There's a lot of groups. And if you're new people, they might be friendly and formal, but it's very hard to break into that group. And so we just had trouble. We had trouble getting in with people and meeting people and really becoming a part. And so we were trying different churches. And the questions just started building. Now I'm viewing the church as a whole on a different, from a different perspective, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't trying to rationalize anything anymore. I was trying to say, this doesn't make sense. No, this isn't right. This is not how it should be. And the very last church we were going to ended with a scandal that gets into politics. So, but the story isn't really the politics. It's how the church handled it.
Yeah.
And they had a friend of mine was leading worship, and he was more of a progressive liberal kind of guy. And then one of the elders was definitely on the Trump train, the MAGA train.
Yeah.
And so one of the elders posted onto his Facebook profile this picture of, I think it was Donald Trump. I think he was kneeling and Jesus was behind him with his hand on his shoulder. And
I know the image you're referring to. Yeah.
Depicting that Jesus was essentially anointing Donald Trump to be the president. And so my friend, who is kind of progressive and liberal, looked at it and thought, what are we doing? Like, you're an elder in the church, and here's what you're like promoting and putting forth.
So was this from the pulpit?
No, it wasn't from the pulpit. It was just his personal Facebook page.
Okay. All right. Okay.
My friend wanted to call it out and say, is that really what we should be doing? Is that our focus in the church? You're an elder in the church. Is that what our focus should be? And so they didn't like that he was raising these questions and calling them out for things. Then on his Twitter page, he was arguing with someone about Joe Biden and his wife versus Trump and Melania. And they were talking about, I didn't ever see it, so I'm taking the second hand, but they're talking about Joe Biden's wife and not representing Christian values. And so my friend took a picture of Melania when, like, from her previous years as a model, and she posed nude. And he posted that to his Twitter and said, "Are these the Christian values you're talking about?" And someone in the church saw that and reported that to the elders. And then they fired him.
Wow.
He released an email to everybody in the church stating that he was fired for posting pornographic material.
Sorry, that it's not funny, but I can't but laugh. That's insane.
It is absolutely insane. So instead of believing the email, I called my friend first and I said, "What in the world is going on?" And he explained to me everything in detail. And I'm like, "So you were actually, forget about whether it was right or wrong to post the picture. What he was genuinely trying to do was stand up for Christian values."
Yeah.
And it was reported. And so then the church came out with a second statement stating that we apologize, we painted the picture wrong. It wasn't pornography, but they still said he posted nudity and that's against our social media values in the church and we don't stand for that. And so he was still fired. And
it's a useful technicality to help just distract from what was actually going on.
They were justifying and rationalizing their own actions.
Yeah.
Not even being willing to admit he was, you know, you could make a statement, okay, maybe he shouldn't have posted a nude photo on his social media, being that you're a member of the church and part of the leadership team. But he was attempting to stand up for Christian values.
He was making a very legitimate, and I've seen exactly the same points in very similar circumstances made elsewhere. So he certainly won't be the first person to make exactly that point. So it's your poor friend. I feel for him, but I don't think it's unique. I think this a similar story to this has happened across many, many churches across the South.
I would believe it. And I had a long talk for hours with the pastor to get his perspective and then weigh it against my friend's perspective and as well as use my own critical thinking and realize you as the church leadership handled this so badly and so poorly but you didn't even own up to it. When you tried to say that you did the first email wrong, you still worded it in such a way that justified your actions and made his actions wrong. And now you've defamed him in the community because now he'd have a hard time getting a job in a church because now he's been fired from this church for pornography. So it kind of ruined his reputation and a lot of his friendships. People stopped being friends with him. We were looked at kind of taking his side. And so people in the church actually stopped contacting us too.
Wow. And I was like, so sorry.
It was the last straw for me because I'd already had so many questions about church and my deconstruction. This was the last straw for me. And I'm like, I'm done. And it leads into a second point about church and home church. But that was the reason why I quit altogether. Even my wife was kind of on board with that. Like, even she could see the way you guys handled this was so disrespectful and not right. So we told them that we were going to leave and start a home church, you know, and that's something that my wife's family had been trying to do for years, probably three different times, and it never worked. So I'm bleeding into an entirely different subject, but it's kind of connected. It goes back to my deconstruction and that. If church is so important for God, he wants you to be part of a church and go to church and not forsake the gathering of the saints and all these things. And my in-laws were convinced that God was telling them it's time to start a home church. But it's never worked. They were never able to get other people involved to make anything consistent. And they haven't even been to a church in a long time. Like we haven't been able to find a church here. And I thought, isn't church important to God? Like, shouldn't he be leading you to find a church? How come we haven't found a church? And every time you guys have decided that God is leading you to start a home church, it's never worked. I'm like, well, how come? I thought this was important to God. So it was another level of deconstruction that the church just isn't working. And each time you're convincing yourself, this is what God is telling you to do. Well, if God's telling you to do it, how come it's not working? You know, so then the blow up and the scandal at the last church I was at was just kind of like, this is not right. Like, here's another level of something that's not making any sense. And adding it to the list along with hell and along with science. And at this point, I'm starting to get very disillusioned. You know, that's, I guess that was around the point when the depression really hit in, because it was like a final nail in the coffin of, this is all wrong. You know, everything you've believed and built your adult life on is wrong. You know, all the decisions you've made, the decisions of getting married and having kids and moving across country and taking this job and going to this church and trying to start a home church, it's all wrong, because all based off a foundation that isn't real. Mm. And when you pull that out from someone's feet, what are they left with? They're left with what they feel like is absolutely nothing. You know, you question every single thing you've ever done in your life at that point. So,
yes, yeah. when you've held with, because going back to what we said earlier about Christianity being viewed as the core of our being, the core of our identity, when you start seriously questioning that, it's not just I'm just analyzing some scientific position that I hold and weighing it against new scientific evidence. You're doing far more than that. You're challenging what you said before, the very methodology, the very pillar by which we tie all our decisions to. And so, of course, that's going to involve some serious personal questioning. And it's hardly surprising that people have depressive episodes when they go through this kind of thing, because it's a complete readjustment of an entire way of thinking, an entire way of analyzing the world around us, you know, from questioning the very basis of morality to other more significant things. So why should we ever be surprised that people struggle with mental health when they go through this? I know I had my own mental health struggles when I went through my own deconstruction, and especially when people are afraid of ostracization from the people that they love the most, they often do this alone, and that just compounds all of those issues. So were you alone when you did this? Was this a struggle that you did mostly on your own, or were there people you could talk to?
No, I was alone. And yeah, part of that is just my own nature. My introvert nature is to, when times are very stressful, to retreat into myself, you know, and so I wanted to hide it from my family.
Yeah.
Because I felt like, I can control this, I'll figure this out.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, when you built your whole view of the entire world, and like I said, in the early days, thinking I'm now learning the secrets of the universe, and then now you're going, it's all falling apart. I don't understand anything at this point, you know?
Yeah.
And you start questioning who you are, you start questioning everything you've done, but I still have to go to work for my family, and I still have to provide, and I still have to be here, and I still have to live up to a certain standard, even though everything's falling down. So I tried to hold it inside, didn't really talk to anybody about it. That's why, you know, the depression sets in.
Yeah.
It eventually bled through into where my wife finally called me out and said, you know, she thought maybe she had done something wrong, or that it was against her, because I became this dark, broody individual. Again, I wasn't abusive. I didn't yell and I wasn't hitting anybody. It was just retreating. It was working all day, coming home, going up to my room and closing the door. And my obsessive brain trying to solve this problem that's essentially kind of unsolvable. But I was obsessed over doing it, you know, and I had to admit that I just don't believe this anymore, you know, and then that, of course, drives the wedge between you and your family, you know. So and as introverts have a hard time finding and making friends, as well as being in your 40s, it just gets more difficult.
Yeah.
So the only friends that I had were in that church. Well, now I don't even have that. So I felt completely and utterly alone. But I just felt like, but you have to do it. You have to control it. You have to figure it out and solve it, because that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't. You know, these are things that you can't control. No human can just have the biggest questions of the universe just simply have everything under control. You know, it's why you kind of have to prop it up, and you have to rationalize Christianity, because you have to make it make sense. And when you make it make sense, you can live in this kind of comfort zone of, you know who you are, you know what you believe. And if anybody asks you questions or challenges your faith, you can just rationalize it away. And so you can just continue on in this kind of bubble. Well, when that bubble bursts, you don't have that anymore. Nice. And now you have to deal with reality. And sometimes reality is just brutal, and it just sucks. And you've got no choice but to figure it out, because you're here and this is what it is. And it's a very bumpy road to go down. And yeah, that caused problems. I've come through that part of it. I deconstructed what I feel like I needed to deconstruct. I've been through all the major tenets of faith, like free will and prayer,
yeah,
and the fruits of the spirit and hell. And once you deconstruct those things, there's really no point to believing anymore. No. You know? And I soft pedaled it for a little while by saying, well, maybe I'm a universalist. You know, maybe I just believe that it doesn't matter what your religion is, we're all trying to get to the top of the mountain and God's at the top, you know? So
yeah.
The Hindus are fine. The Islam is fine. It's all, as long as you've got a genuine heart and you're trying, you're good. But that didn't last very long, you know, because at that point you think again, well, what's the point then? Because you can just believe what you want to believe. And if that's the case, well, then who cares? Why do I need to pick a religion if I can just believe what I want to believe, you know? Mm. And so, and then believing that when the Bible is not inerrant, it's faulty. So why do I need to take a progressive Christian path? If the Bible is faulty and it's not inerrantly true, well, then what's the point again? Because everybody can just interpret it and translate it however they want.
Which, well, they do.
Which they do. I don't need to do that.
No, quite.
If this God of the universe, who is so vast in scale, can't even deliver a book that makes sense,
yeah,
then there's no point. That can't be the way. You know, why would the God who can create a black hole and neutron stars, if this is the message he needs to give to us, and then he gives us a book that for thousands of years you cannot even get Christians to agree what it says,
yeah,
then that can't be the God who created the black holes. He not only created the black holes that are millions of times more massive than our sun, but he created the tiny, tiny quarks and electrons that make up the building blocks of matter.
Mm-hmm.
But he can't deliver a message in a concise manner that makes sense. It's like, once you reach that point, you realize, yeah, there's no point to any of this. There's no point to being a progressive Christian. There's no point to being a universalist, because none of this makes sense.
And I agree. And you've described a journey that's very similar to my own. I went through very similar thought processes along the lines of, you know, what lighter, softer form of Christianity can I hold to make all this true? And I very quickly came to the conclusion that, well, I can't justify any of it. Why am I jumping through so much hoops? Why am I putting so much effort into trying to find a form of Christianity that I can accept, when none of it matches the reality that I'm seeing? There isn't a link. There isn't a road between the two. Why am I trying to build one? Just give up. And when the day that I gave up was the day that my happiness level jumped up as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I was downstairs in the garage just tinkering around, and I had my headphones on and I was listening to music, and I'm a huge metalhead. And this band came on, and there's a song called Agnosticism, and the song isn't like a super deep idea. It was just this very basic, fun level idea of looking at science versus religion, and each one claiming to know what the truth is, but finding balance in the middle of being an agnostic. I'm not an agnostic now, but at that moment when I heard that, I realized, yeah, you're not a believer. And when I admitted it to myself, that was a turning point in my depression going away. The depression ultimately was me trying to pretend and hide and hold on to something that I knew was not true. So once I was able to admit to myself, you don't believe it's true, just admit it. And then, like I said, my happiness level jumped. I felt much more peace admitting that truth to myself. And even though I don't consider myself agnostic now, I would consider myself religiously atheist, in that I simply do not believe in any God that has to do with religion. I guess I could be agnostic on the idea if there is some sort of deity out there, it's not one that has anything to do with our menial religions here on earth.
Yeah.
You know, there could be something that doesn't interfere in our lives who just started the universe. I don't see why that's any weirder than believing in multiple universes and stuff. You're reaching a point where we don't know it. We don't know that answer. There could be. It just cannot be the God that we've created religiously here. You know, I reject that notion. So,
yes, and I agree with you, and I'm in a similar state. So we're heading into the wind up now. So, but a couple of things I just like to polish up. My journey with my own wife is similar to what you said. My wife still believes. I kept it from her until the very last minute, until I was caught out in it. It's not a strategy that I recommend. I've said it on numerous occasions that you need to be brave and you need to try and be honest and open sooner. My motivation for not was because I knew that what I said would be hurtful, would cause concern. And I wanted to come up with a way to say it which wouldn't. And I failed abysmally to find a way to say it that wouldn't. But I still maintain that we should try and have these conversations earlier, even if they are hurtful and difficult, because it creates an opportunity for dialogue. For me, one of the most damaging parts of my deconstruction between myself and my wife was I was a done deal. I was out. The ship had sailed. There was no way back for me. And then I said, by the way, darling, I'm atheist. That's really hard on the Christian to hear. That's really hard on the partner. And it's because I trapped myself. You know, I didn't want to hurt her, so I kept quiet. And by being quiet, I hurt her. You know, we create a whirlpool for ourselves when we do that. So my advice to others, and it'll be interesting to see if you agree, I'm hoping you do, but you're not committed to agreeing. Be open and be open as early as possible. What advice would you give to anybody who's listening to this, who's in the early stages of their deconstruction, they're concerned about a partner who still believes, and how to have those conversations? What would you say to them?
I would agree. It's probably better to let them at least know you're questioning. Yeah. You're having some things that aren't making sense, versus going through a couple of years of darkness and depression and then unloading.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't look at now at everything as being a matter of good or evil or right or wrong. You know, our personalities are what they are, and there's, you could say, positive and negatives to every bit of it. And I would think it's one of the negative things of my personality is that retreating, because I feel like I'm trying to control everything. In my mind, I'm trying to protect them from what I'm going through. But ultimately, it doesn't protect them at all. In fact, they can feel alienated. And if you keep them out of what you're struggling with, then they don't feel like you're letting them be a part of your life, to where you can kind of go through it together. It's a tough thing to do. It's a tough thing to say what anybody should or shouldn't do in their situation. Mm-hmm. But I would say that communication is more important than lack of communication. So that's probably something I look back and think, yeah, I could have handled that differently. You know, I could have handled it a little better. Not that it would have ultimately made things a lot easier, but at least they could have been a part of that and known what's going on versus a couple of years of a moody person in the house.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I love the way that you've expressed that. You've expressed that in a very compassionate and loving way. And I really like that. Thank you for that. Because ultimately, what we do by keeping quiet is we rob our partners, those who love us the most, of walking down that journey with us. And we're robbing them of that experience, and we're being unhelpful to them. And it has potentially to create more damage, as I already said. But it's difficult for both sides, this story. And sometimes we can focus just on our own concerns. Sorry, my dog's barking in the background. There's a very real risk when we're doing this that we spiral into our own fears. And sometimes it's helpful for us to be able to just take a step back and think about the consequence of others and give other people the opportunity to walk with us down this road, to hold a hand when we're low. And even if we don't end up at the same destination, at least they've had an opportunity to hug us along the way.
Yeah, no, I agree. And life is just about learning, really. It's about moving forward and learning. And, you know, those are hard lessons that I've learned about myself, because in my relationships with people, the tendency to retreat, even if it's just a platonic friend.
Yeah.
Is strong, but then you're essentially telling them they can't be a part of this part of your life.
Yes.
And that's not a real healthy message for really strong relationships. And I think the balance would be that friends and family and loved ones should understand that, like, I need time alone. Mm-hmm. But on the same side, I should understand that I need to involve them in what I'm dealing with. That's what a relationship is. So locking people out is not really a relationship.
No.
In the same way, them not giving you space to have your alone time and to detox is also not a healthy relationship. And so you got to learn to balance these things. And it's not an easy task, but I think it's an important task.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that, Jake. Is there anything more that you would like to say to our listeners, or any resources you would like to point in their direction? This is the opportunity for you to plug anything.
As far as resources go, I would get on YouTube and just start. You know, I know people are going to be in different phases of this. You know, some people are already full on just atheist, and some people might be in a stage where they're just starting to question and they're starting to look elsewhere. Start educating yourself, because you can go to a used bookstore and go to a science section like I do all the time. And I got 3 or 4 science books on evolution and on astrophysics and different things they were all under $10. So between YouTube and used bookstores, the ability to educate yourself is just all right there at your fingertips. So if you are questioning, or if you're curious about something, by all means, go for it. There's not one science book I'm going to recommend, because there's hundreds of them, then they're all good. So just start, you know, understand the scale of the universe. If you want to understand the God that you're talking about, we make him so human and so small, but we claim that he's beyond space and time. So start educating yourself on what that means, and then compare it to what you see in the little churches, you know. I mean, I could go on and on about, like I said, the ideas of prayer and free will and all these things, but that could take another couple hours to. The important thing is to not lock yourself into saying, this is what I believe and that's it. Start asking questions and learning and educating yourself. You, like I said, with social media, you know, and used bookstores and all these things, there's so much at your fingertips that you can learn and understand, and go for it. You know, maybe you strengthen your beliefs, maybe you challenge your beliefs. Either way, you're not staying stagnant. If I think stagnancy just leads to death, death of your own personal vision, your personal dreams and passions. So just get out there and start. What I will say, a funny kind of anecdote that I talked about on the deconversion Facebook page. I took to heart the biblical adage of asking, seeking, and knocking. It says it. It says ask, seek, and knock.
Yeah.
And I look at it and go, that's exactly what I did. I started asking questions. I started seeking answers. And I started knocking on doors looking for those answers. And this is where it's led me. So do it. I'm gonna ramble on. Just okay. don't stay stagnant. Just go out there and start learning.
Let your curiosity lead you. Thank you so much, Jake. There will be some resources in the show notes, a link to the debate that Jake mentioned earlier. I'll see if I can dig out a link to that song, Agnosticism, see if I can find that as well. That'll be a fun challenge for me. And I'll see if I can find some appropriate YouTube channels that you might be able to start your journey with if you're not already a YouTuber aficionado. So check the show notes for anything on that. Lovely chatting to you, Jake. I've really enjoyed that. Thank you for responding to my call out on the Deconversion Anonymous Facebook group. And until next time, listeners, stay reasonable. You have been listening to a podcast from Reason Press. Do you have any thoughts on what you've just heard? Do you have a topic that you would like us to cover? Please send all feedback to reasonpress@gmail.com. You might even appear on an episode. Our theme music was written for us by Holly. To hear more of her music, see the links in our show notes.